It is noon on a Monday, and that means In Context, military affairs commentator and public service program at PKN Radio, 89.5 WPKN.org. On the line will be Ken McDermott Rowe and Marshawn from wherever they're housed up today at this time.
Hi,
on the snowy.
This is Ken. I'm here with Marshawn. Hello, Del.
How are you?
And to listeners, welcome to In Context, WPKN's live public affairs show. I'm Ken McDermott Rowe, your host, and you can hear In Context every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month when WPKN's general manager, Steve, reports to listeners. Our website is incontextreport.com. You can check us out on Facebook and see our videos on the In Context Report channel on YouTube. Because of the snowstorm, Marchand and I are joining the program via phone. Marchand is our military affairs commentator at In Context.
Good afternoon, everyone.
And in the WPKN studio in Bridgeport is Dell, our guest commentator, who is also manning the control board at WPKN. And Bridgeport is among the communities most hard hit by last weekend's snowstorm. And Dell and people like Eric Cox are among the small group of dedicated WPKN volunteers who have performed heroically and keeping this non-commercial listener-sponsored community station on the air as Bridgeport slowly digs its way out. And folks, Dell walked 3 miles. He walked 3 miles to get to the studio this morning so that we could be broadcasting today. So, Dell, thanks very much. That's a story you can tell your grandchildren, right?
If I ever have any. You can thank Bruce Swan, too. Bruce is here. He trudged mile after mile get here, too, one way or the other.
It's a tough situation. I think the university is officially closed, and the roads in Bridgeport are just horrendous. Now, Dell, you host your own show on WPKN. When can people listen to you?
I'm on 2nd, 4th, and 5th Friday in the morning, 7 to 9. Among other fill-in things, I happen to be lucky enough to be in Bridgeport. So this is my home, man. So that's why I'm here now and forever until somebody sanctions me to go on tour somewhere.
Well, there's lots of news that's been happening since our last In Context.
Tell us about it, will you? Tell us about it.
And, one of the things we need to talk about is the recent Israeli attack on Syria, with the first overt attack by a Western allied power on Syria. But there's been a dramatic development, Marshawn, that I'd like you to talk about regarding the increasingly hostile dispute between China and Japan over a group of uninhabited islands in the China Sea. But these uninhabited islands happen to have in their vicinity some very important natural gas or oil reserves.
Well, exactly. It's actually, you know, I feel like the United States is getting to the point of where, you know, that old Afghanistan photograph which showed the Russian bear and the British lion circling the Afghan and says, "Save me from my friends." We're kind of in that position now because, on the one hand, the Chinese demand the islands. They have no natural gas in them themselves. I mean, the Chinese don't. And so the islands do. So the Chinese want the islands. Well, you know, historically, were the islands Chinese or Japanese? That's always up for debate because they exchanged hands so many times. But the fact is, though, is that the Japanese have basically said, look, the Chinese are violating our airspace. The Chinese are sending in ships. You know, this is the kind of thing that should go to an international court. But the Chinese are taking military action. And the Japanese are saying, look, America, come in and help. Come in and, you know, tell the Chinese to get out of our face. Well, President Obama and the administration as a whole, in its usual fantastic dithering manner, has done absolutely nothing. They've ranted and raved about Assad's chemical weapons, but have done nothing about the fact that Chinese warships have targeted Japanese naval vessels, the fact that Chinese aircraft have, military aircraft have violated Japanese airspace. I mean, the fact that this could, the only reason this could spark into a war is because the United States refuses to intervene. You know, we're willing to intervene in Afghanistan. We're willing to intervene in Syria, a place where people don't want us. When the Japanese need our help, when the South Koreans need our help, we go, meh. And so the problem is we're at that point where the Chinese might spark a conflict, or very well the Japanese or South Koreans might spark a conflict in order to get us involved.
Well, and again, to put this in context, since the end of World War II, we have been allied with Japan. Japan's our major ally in the Pacific. We have a mutual defense treaty. If they go to war with China, then we're more involved in it. China, on the other hand, is the great expanding power in the Pacific, and President Obama recently announced what he called his Asian pivot. He's moving a majority of our fleet to the Pacific, presumably, obviously to counter China's expanding influence. We're also engaged in forging renewing military alliances in Southeast Asia and stationing troops in Australia.
Yeah, but it's really, I mean, it is a bit of a misnomer when he says, you know, we're pivoting, we're focusing on Asia. In reality, 4,000 Marines in Australia relative to a 35 million man Chinese army, the thing is what Obama's trying to do is say, if I put Americans here, China will be frightened and go away. But the fact is that China's not frightened of us anymore. But the big problem, in addition, is, as I mentioned, is that we are not only looking at an aggressive China, but we're looking at desperate allies. The South Koreans are terrified that the North Koreans, under their new leader, might develop another nuclear weapon. They've already successfully launched a missile that could hit the United States. The South Koreans are terrified. The Japanese are terrified of Chinese aggression. And they're begging us for help. We're not doing anything. And so, like I say, I wouldn't put it beyond the Japanese or the South Koreans to launch a first strike.
Vis-a-vis that, it was just reported last week in the Army Times that General James Thurston, who commands the U.S. Army in South Korea, he is quoted as saying that South Korea is in a period of high vulnerability, and this is following North Korea's test of long-range rockets in last December.
Well, that's precisely why, according to Russia Today, the South Koreans said that they are preparing to launch a first strike. They are ready to launch a first strike if they think North Korea is going to test a nuclear weapon. Now, you know, we all know North Korea is the puppet of China, so it would spark a wider conflict with China. Definitely, the South Koreans do not have the military capability to hold off or launch an offensive against the North Koreans. They would require U.S. military aid and U.S. forces. We have about 40,000, 50,000 troops there. But what's significant, though, is that this would drag us, and the South Koreans know this, it would drag us kicking and screaming into a war, because President Obama can dither all he wants, but if war breaks out in the Korean Peninsula, if war breaks out with Japan, if war breaks out in Israel and Syria, we're obligated by treaty to intervene. And so that's why I say, you know, save me from my friends. You know, all the people most likely to drag us into a war are our allies.
You know, Marshawn, as we've talked about this growing tension around the world, and I'm thinking of that Kink song, Everybody's Fighting, They're Even Talking of a War. The analogy that you've often cited is to World War One, just before World War One, and that we're in a situation where any spark could ignite the fire.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you have, you have the Japanese and the Chinese, both of which are ready to go at each other. You have the South Koreans and the North Koreans who are ready to go at each other. And then, of course, in the Middle East, Israel bombing Syria. The whole reason Israel bombed Syria was in order to provoke a Syrian response. And a lot of this has to do with the fact that they know we're militarily obligated to defend them by treaty, but they know at the same time we don't want to. We're not, you know, our leadership isn't very aggressive, you know, and it's much in a similar way that the Serbs knew that the Russians would militarily come to their defense in World War One if they were invaded, but they knew the Russians wouldn't go out of their way to fight Austro-Hungary.
Yeah, I think on one hand, Americans should be grateful we don't have a trigger-happy president, but on the other hand, when Ronald Reagan was president, or even Bush Jr., our potential adversaries were very concerned that these guys could just go off at any moment, and so they tended to be more conservative. But when you look at a guy like President Obama, who seems to be influenced by his generals, who are telling him, look, you don't want a land war in Syria, you don't want a land war in Asia, let's not get rushed into something, that's probably good policy in one sense, but on the other hand, it's sending a signal to countries like China, Russia, Iran, that we could be pushed around.
Well, and not just that, but you can't tell your ally, listen, we're not going to, South Korea and Japan, we're only going to allow you to have certain weapons, right? We're only going to allow you to have certain weapons because we will come to your defense in the event of a crisis.
Well, that's especially strong with Japan in that case, right? With Japan, by its constitution.
But it's the same case with South Korea. It's the same, even with Israel. The fact is that all three countries, we tell them, don't worry, we will come to your defense in the event of a crisis. Well, they see a looming crisis. In the case of the Israelis, they see that they might be pushed into the Mediterranean. In the case of the South Koreans, they see they might be invaded by the North. In the case of the Japanese, they see they might be invaded by China. And so now they're all calling on us to do something. Well, and the problem is that you know, we don't want to, but at the same time, we're not allowing them to defend themselves. I mean, if President Obama really wanted to distance himself, what he would do is he would say to the Japanese, you can have a regular army, we will supply you with arms, but we will not militarily get involved if you get into trouble.
How big is the Japanese army?
About 500,000.
And I think, well, Marshawn, when you were over there a couple years ago, you saw some of the soldiers training, right? You weren't too impressed with their equipment.
No, their equipment was fairly antiquated. It was, I mean, the thing is, their military is, relative to ours, you know, it's tiny. And most of their GDP isn't allowed to go to the military.
Now, this is the third largest economy in the world, I believe, after the U.S. and China.
And that's part of the problem, is we don't want any competitors. So we defeat our enemies, we basically subjugate them, and then we say, well, don't worry, if there's an attack, we'll defend you. Now we don't want to live up to that, but at the same time, we don't want to let them go.
Well,
I mean, like I say, realistically we should do, if President Obama was sincere, I'm more inclined to believe, you know, that he's not very bright, you know, compared to being a non-interventionist. I just think he's simply not very smart.
Well,
I think he really thinks that the Chinese are not going to try anything, because the fact is that if we were serious about Japan's defense, we would say, listen, we don't have the manpower to defend you, but we will allow you to have an army. We will supply your army. We will train your army, but we will not militarily get involved in confrontation.
Our foreign policy, even if one subscribes to the idea that we should be continuing this military expansion. Folks, we are in a very aggressive military expansion, the third decade. It began in 1991 with our invasion of the Persian Gulf. In the corporate media, you were presented with all these ad hoc reasons for each war, as if, you know, we were just kind of being dragged reluctantly into these involvements. And that is completely misleading. This is a coherent plan to spread American hegemony around the world. And it started with the Persian Gulf invasion immediately after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And this business about humanitarian interventions or weapons of mass destruction, these are things that are just ginned up for mass consumption in order to rationalize, to give an ideological foundation for an expansionary foreign policy. Now, if we think that's a good policy, if you happen to think that's a good policy,
it's a terrible policy.
I would say it's not a good policy. I think we should be defending this country instead. But if you think it's a good policy, then you have to ask, is a handful of troops in Korea or a small army in Japan going to be adequate to pursue this policy?
Well, and that's kind of the point that I'm trying to make, is that we don't have the manpower. If we were serious and we were sincere about Japan's defense, what we would do is we would allow them to have a military. But instead, it seems like I say, are they either naive or stupid?
Well, Adele, what do you think about this?
Well, I want to know, what are they going to do about Syria?
Well,
that brings us to the January 30th attack by Israel on Syria, the first overt action by a Western allied power. As we've been explaining on In Context for the last year and a half, what's been portrayed in the corporate media as a spontaneous, indigenous, democratic uprising in Syria is, in fact, a surrogate war between the United States and its allies on one side and Russia and Iran on the other side for control of this very strategically important neighbor of Iran, Iran being the ultimate the prize in the region for any power because of its massive amounts of natural gas and oil, and that this portrayal is absolutely inaccurate, that it's a democratic, it's purely indigenous uprising. And what it looks to be happening now is that with the help of Russia and Iran, the Syrian government under Assad is being successful in putting it down. And and Israel attacked on January 30, the bombing campaign in Syria, and its principal target was a cache of a depot where there are some very advanced, sophisticated weapons that Iran was in the process, had imported in Syria with a view to, Israel thinks, to bring it further into Lebanon, things like the SA-17 anti-aircraft missile, which are generally believed to be game-changing weapons and a potential clash in the region should it escalate further. So then the question is what Syria might do. The Iranian government sent a representative, the head of their national security directory, to Syria for consultation to see what kind of response they're going to have. But then, Dell, where is this thing going to blow up into a bigger war? Should we be getting the heck out of there, or are we getting sucked into something we don't want to do? What do you think, Dell?
We're in the middle of the big triangle. Let's not forget the Muslim Brotherhood and Ahmadinejad meeting last week. And let's not forget Mali in northern Africa. We're in the middle of a lot of stuff, and anything can just powder keg it out of there and suck us in.
Well, I think you hit it right on the head. I mean, that's part of the problem, is that we're at this point messing with forces that we don't quite comprehend.
You can't control them either.
Oh yeah, absolutely. We can't control them at all.
I mean, I think our government thinks we can control the world. It's not going to happen.
Well, and that's part of the problem. I mean, originally the idea was that, oh, you know, we'll send a few special forces, a few Green Berets and Navy SEALs into Syria. We'll topple Assad. Then we'll scare the Iranians, and then, you know, we'll control the region. But the fact is that what we're starting to see, well, what we started to see a long time ago is Assad, it looked like Assad was going to fall. The Russians upped the ante and deployed troops.
Right.
So we deployed more overt special forces. We deploy a carrier battle group. They deploy 15 warships, which are still off the coast of Syria. Our fleet left. It looked like they were preparing to launch a strike on Syria, and they left because the Russian fleet showed up. And then we deploy Patriot missiles. The Russians deploy Iskander ballistic missiles. So every time we up the ante a little bit, they up the ante twice as much. And I think that's something that we were not prepared for at all, how aggressive Iran is being, Egypt appears to be playing both sides. I mean,
what are we giving them jets for?
Paid contract or not? That honestly is one of those things that I think it's really a case of our government's broke and we need the money. I mean, really, it sounds completely mercenary, but
these are foreign military sales.
Well, no, these are sales to Egypt specifically.
Yeah.
We're delivering to Egypt something ballpark of 200 tanks, and I don't remember the number on the jets, but it was something like 20
politics,
jets.
Marshawn, because we give Egypt, I think, like $1.5 billion a year, and the idea may be that they recycle that back to our armaments industry.
Was a separate contract.
Oh, this is a separate.
Yeah, this wasn't part of the $1 billion a year we gave them. This was a separate contract that they had signed to buy armaments from us. But I think a lot of it, I mean, strategically speaking, it's a stupid decision. It's clear Iran's playing both sides, and when, you know, the proverbial poo hits the fan, people are going, you know, Egypt will side with whoever they think the winner's going to be. And for us to give Egypt an arsenal is a terrible idea at this stage.
Well, you know,
but
speaking of that relationship, Marshawn, the Iranian president, Ahmadinejad, just visited Cairo, and he was offering a pact with Egypt to, quote, solve the Palestinian problem.
But that's where I was going to cite Egypt's playing both sides, because on the one hand, they tell Ahmadinejad, no, we will not join your crusade against Israel. But then on the other hand, they're allowing armaments into Gaza. Egypt's playing both sides. Historically true Egyptian fashion, they're trying to find out who the winner's going to be before they pick sides.
You know, Dell, it seems like we've got the press folk voice on us this simplistic notion that there are good guys in the Mideast and bad guys. The good guys are the ones that like the U.S. foreign policy, expansionary foreign policy, and the bad guys are the ones who don't. And it seems to be like totally with disregard to whatever is really going on in their own countries.
I think we're kind of on our own. But everybody should just get the idea that we're on our own, and we should take care of our own country. Don't you think?
I think you're absolutely right.
We've got 20 programs here in these subjects we've just brought up in the last 10 minutes. So I think we should pick a subject and open up the phones.
Okay, sounds great.
Unless you were just doing
let's
commentary
do it
today.
The call-in number is 203-336-9756.
What are we going to talk? What's the topic then?
And
we could talk about 20 countries.
Let me throw this idea out.
All right.
We're engaged in a continuation of this huge military expansion. It's a bad idea. That's my view. It's a bad idea. Maybe callers disagree. Are we giving President Obama a free pass on the continuation of this horrible policy because he's a Democrat, because he's supposedly a liberal, because he's an African-American?
I don't think so.
Is that what's going on here? Because he should be getting the same heat that Bush Jr. got. So how about what do people think of that?
Well, are you talking media bias here? Or are you talking about just? I mean,
I'm just saying the American public they're not out in the streets protesting this policy, this expansionary policy, these you know drone assassinations that the Obama's program of assassinating people without trial.
There's another subject.
Drone, you know? Why aren't people out there objecting? Is it because he's a Democrat? Is it because he's a liberal or an African American? They feel that somehow it's inappropriate. He must be doing the right thing.
Honestly, I think it's because to a great extent, Bush was a comical character that everybody loved to hate. You know, he was like the comical bad guy, the kind of cartoon bad guy. You know, he got up there, he would say stupid things, and everybody would have a laugh at him and be like, oh, you know, what a buffoon. And he was easy for people to say, oh, you know, he's evil, we're good, he's war, we're anti-war. Then Obama comes in with hope and change, and I think when he really came in, people genuinely thought everything's going to be different now. And now the problem is that once people have realized that he's not any different, people have a hard time coping with the concept of, you know, there's, you know, the good and bad, evil versus good, is not as black and white as we think it is.
Ralph Nader said, "It's one monster. It's one monster with two heads."
Exactly.
And I think that's the reality. We'd like to know what you think. Give us a call at In Context. It's 203-336-9756. My name is Ken McDermott Rowe. I'm here with Marshawn Handel, and we'd like to talk to you about the issue, our foreign policy issues. What you think of President Obama's handling? Give us a ring at 203-336-9756. We'll be on for another half an hour, so give us a call now so you can get in the conversation. And if you prefer to write us, you can drop us an email. We'll get it immediately if you send it to ken@mdrtalk.org. That's ken@mdrtalk.org.
So what do you guys think rhymes with change?
That's a good question. I don't know. What does rhyme with change?
Well, I've got hope and change, and I got hip and something else to rhyme with change that goes into, you know, the two sides of Obama.
Yeah.
And what people think of him.
Yeah.
Hold the line. Let's see who's there. You guys keep talking.
Sure.
But yeah, I think that's one of the fundamental problems that people have is that, you know, he was hope and change. He was, you know, he was cool, he was young, he was, you know, he was everything that everybody wanted in a president. It was like getting a movie star as a president.
Yeah.
If you think about it, every president before has been kind of, you know, in their 60s or 70s, and they, you know, they're kind of getting up there in years, and they're the old grandfatherly figure. Now you get President Obama as the young, hip, and, you know, hope, and I'm going to change everything. And then when people find out he's not any different, people have a really hard time looking at that. I mean, it would be almost like, you know, it's almost like after the Bolshevik Revolution when Stalin came to power and thought, oh, he's an old comrade of the revolution. He'll carry on Lenin's banner. He'll fix everything. And then it turned out he was worse than the czars were. You know, so people had a hard time confronting that.
You know, both parties seem to be controlled by the same corporate interests. There's a little slanty difference, a little bit of a difference, but it seems like they pick guys who are good front men to give us bad news. Reagan was a good one too, because here was a guy who broke unions. He set in motion this lowering of the middle class. He really accelerated the decline of the middle class. But he was such a nice guy. I mean, even if you didn't like him, you listened to him on TV. He was really a likable person.
But Reagan also did something for the country, so people took the good with the bad.
Yeah, he was really breaking the working class in this country.
But you look at what came on his heels. I mean, the economy did well. You know, nobody messed with us because they were afraid that this guy was not. You know, this guy was not afraid to push the button.
That's true. The economy looked great in the '80s compared to now. That's
well, I mean, this. I cannot think of one solitary thing. I mean, this guy's increased the drone strikes. He's authorized torture. I mean, that appalls me. And now he's authorized the torturing of American citizens, the killing by drones of American citizens, through the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 and 2013.
We have a call?
Oh, yes.
We've got Joe from Brewster on the line. Joe, you with me?
Hi, Joe.
Yes, I'm here.
All right. You're on the line with, my name's Dell, and we have Ken McDermott Rowe and Marshawn from In Context. Pose your question.
Okay, fellas. One question I got is that we send money to all these countries around the world. They don't like us anyway. Supposedly we're in bed with them. How about we finish what we're doing in bed, get out of bed, and walk away like a gentleman would when he's done with a woman. And wow. say, okay, you know what? Now we're done with you. We want nothing more to do with you because basically your whole population hates us and hates America anyway. You know what? You know, no one asked me, hey Joe, you want to send $1 billion to these people who hate us anyway? I would say no.
Yeah, like I said, going to ask your permission to do
it. Well, I know they'll never ask. I mean, but how about somewhere in the government or somewhere, some people with money, some people with influence, some people in big business say, hey, U.S. government, you're killing us here. You're killing the American people by giving all our money away, protecting people that hate us. The price of oil and gas is through the roof because why? Because we protect them. So other countries around them won't come in and rob their oil from them. Why not? Because they're aware with all our big military.
Well, I think you know? right on.
Thanks, Joe, for your call. Appreciate it.
Thank
all
you
right.
very much.
Thanks, Joe.
And I think that is part of a huge problem, but that's what Congress is supposed to be there for. But that's how, you know, our elected representatives aren't really representing our interests. I mean, as Joe mentioned, is it in our interest to have, you know, to send all of these armaments to Al-Qaeda in Libya so that we can overthrow Gaddafi, or Al-Qaeda in Syria so we can overthrow Assad? I mean, you know, not that Gaddafi or Assad were great guys, but, I mean, so a little bit of common sense here.
It's just one more thing. You put up somebody else in some other country, you try to let democracy work, and all these other forces come in, and they tend to turn on us everywhere we go, one way or the other.
Exactly. Well, in a lot of cases, like I know in Egypt, part of the backlash, I mean, I spent a lot of time in Egypt, and one of the reasons for the backlash was the Egyptians were very bitter over the fact that they do not feel that America came in and gave them democracy. We propped up Mubarak. We allowed Mubarak to torture and rape and murder. And, you know, if you spoke out against Mubarak, you got your fingernails pulled out. If you were a woman, you got raped by Mubarak's police. And we endorsed that. And we, you know, here's President Bush and President Obama and Clinton and all of them shaking hands with Mubarak like he's the greatest guy in the world. And so the Egyptians look at that and they go, these schmucks. And then President Obama, in traditional Obama fashion, comes out when there's the revolution, says, Mubarak must stay, Mubarak must stay. Well, and then when the military finally kicks Mubarak out, Obama then comes out and says, it's time for democracy in Egypt. So the Egyptians look at us, they say these Americans are insincere, they're, you know, when they talk about democracy and everything, but they don't mean it. They don't mean what they say. Democracy, so long as it's their stooge. And that's one of the reasons why you get this backlash. I mean, we came into Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, we said, you guys have democracy, you guys have free market economy, and all the Russians went, yes, and then they went, we're all horribly poor.
You know, I want to know, Adele, how do we get to this point where the American people think that it's normal to be fighting wars all over the world, to have 700 foreign military bases, when up until World War II, most of our leaders said, hey, we should stay out of this stuff. The Republican Party was firmly, under people like the great Senator Robert Taft of Ohio, firmly against foreign wars. They said, our army is here to defend the United States. And somehow today, people now accept we're all over the place and we're fighting wars over the world, and we spend about $800 billion a year in defense while our roads are crumbling. I don't get it. How do they accept that as normal?
Well, Ron Paul's also not an idiot for those same types of idealistic thinking. And he's got his shortfalls, too. But those ideas of not waging war on everybody, we're not going to win this thing, guys. No matter what you think we're doing over there or in any place, we look like freaking idiots, excuse my effing. But do you think they trust? Imagine being our soldiers being over there that nobody trusts.
Yeah, like right. In Afghanistan, yeah.
Well, maybe the local population does on some accounts, but there's a lot of people that look at us badly.
Well, and that's the other thing, you know. Our young men and women are getting killed because, well, A, you know, if President Obama or, you know, the leadership in this country were sincere about, you know, democracy in Afghanistan, I think the Afghans would be able to trust us a bit better because, I mean, let's face it. We came in and we put in Hamid Karzai, who's of the Durrani tribe of the Pashto, and the Durrani were the traditional kings of Afghanistan. So we basically come in and we say, here is your president for life, you know, Hamid Karzai. And so the Afghans look at us like, you hypocrites. And so then at the same time, we also can't provide them with security because we only have 60,000 troops there. And so the you know, we roll into an Afghan village and we say, you better support democracy, and then we roll out and the Taliban roll back in.
And it's not like we've deluded people, too, into thinking, well, with 60,000 troops, we can win a war in Afghanistan. Completely wrong idea. And yet, if you told them we'd need to send a million Americans to Afghanistan to really control this country, and we need to have the draft to do so, Dell, if you spoke to them frankly like that, do you think anybody would support it?
I highly doubt it.
The people are okay with it.
They will support it if it means money in their pockets and food for the children and the rest of that. But governments don't think on those levels a lot of times. Because there's more pressing matters. It is the lesser of two evils that we put these puppet guys in position.
That's right. That's right. And if you'd like to express your point of view on this, give
us
a ring. The name of the show is In Context. You're listening to WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut. And our call-in number is 203-336-9756. My name is Ken. I'm on the line as Marshawn McDermott Rowe, our military affairs commentator, and also our guest commentator, Dell, is in the studio. So give us a ring at 203-336-9756. We'll be on the air for about another 22 minutes, and we very much like to hear what you think about these important issues.
Well, I mean, and that's one of the things that I think is fundamentally one of the reasons why people don't care about the war in Afghanistan, so long as volunteers are getting killed, you know, whatever, these guys volunteered for it. That's part of the people's attitude. And I think also part of the attitude as well is a sense of complete detachment from the concept of war. I mean, let's face it, as far as people are concerned about war, you know, war is what occurs in movies. You know, it's acts of valor. It's a handful of Navy SEALs go and shoot the bad guy and get out. You know, it's Call of Duty, a bunch of, you know, Delta Force Green Berets go in and they, you know, blow something up. They destroy the Russian fleet. And, you know, all we need is a handful of special forces and they'll do it. What they don't realize is because we have 60,000 troops, we can't provide security, so people are forced to support the Taliban, whether they want to or not. And our troops are basically getting killed for no other reason than fighting a holding action. And the only reason why we're fighting this holding action is because of apathy. So basically, in a nutshell, the average American soldier is getting killed because of the apathy of the American citizenry who are too detached to really want to change it,
yep,
I feel like.
We have some commentary on the line if you want to talk.
Sure. Do we have a caller?
Yeah, Lorenzo from New Haven is calling and wanted to talk. Lorenzo, you with us?
Hi, Lorenzo. All right.
Hey, everybody. I love your show, love your commentary. It's so nice to hear educated people talking about the real world.
Thank you. Well,
thank you very much.
But I'm just really puzzled by this whole Syrian thing in that we're supporting the side with Al-Qaeda, religious Muslim Sunni Salafi fanatics versus, granted, Assad's not a good guy, but he's certainly no worse than the side we're supporting. And more importantly, the people that in Syria that are in related, quote, related to Western civilization, i.e. the Kurds, i.e. the numerous Christian churches, a couple of whom have the world headquarters in Syria, they are all behind Assad here.
Yeah, he has a fairly secular and relatively tolerant regime, right?
Right. If you would, let me give you another example. If you and I were Syrians and I was a guy and, you know, you were an attractive girl, we could go to the cafe, we could have a couple drinks, and we could go down the beach and she could put on her bathing suit and we could go swimming.
Yeah.
With the rebels, they would cut her head off and God knows what they'd do to me. You know, for the same thing.
Well, and that's, you know, one of the things I like to point out is so ludicrous about American policy. I mean, let's face it, you know, like I say, we talk about democracy, and, you know, here we're these democratic freedom fighters, when in reality they're worse and more oppressive than Assad is. But there's a pattern here. And this is one of the reasons why, again, you know, people don't trust Americans bearing gifts. You know, from the Iliad, right? Beware of Greeks bearing gifts.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same thing, you know, beware of Americans bearing gifts, because we show up and we're like, Libya, we'll give you democracy. So we fund Al-Qaeda, Wahhabi militants, and we say, you know, here, we give you all these guns. And then the moment Gaddafi's gone, we go, all right, wash our hands of it. Well, you're done. Good luck. And then we do the same thing in Afghanistan when the Soviets were there.
Right.
We kick the Soviets out. We tell the Afghan Mujahideen, well, you know, we'll help you build the government. And then when the Soviets leave, we go, well, see ya. And then the Taliban take over, drug lords take over, and then the Taliban. But so there's a pattern here of
allies of convenience. If the Al-Qaeda is convenient to be allied with, we're allied with them. If Al-Qaeda is the boogeyman, they'll give us a pretext for invading a country,
it's also a principle that it's kind of like I think people always say it's easier to knock down a sandcastle than it is to build one. You know, it's always easier to destroy a country than it is to build one. We will go in, we will help these militants, we will destroy the country. But then when it comes to the actual problem of helping them to build a democratic society, well, that's not really why we're there. That's not really why we're concerned. Our main concern was either, in the case of Afghanistan, kicking the Soviets out, whether these people all lived under a totalitarian regime. We didn't care. As long as the Soviets were out of Afghanistan.
These are
millennial struggles, which we are never going to be able to pacify. I mean, these have been going on for thousands of years, a majority of the issues we're talking about.
Sure.
And
sure.
So are we going to... We should just become an isolationist country and spend money on ourselves. And I'm going to let you guys go, but again, thank you very much for your very insightful comments.
Thanks for your call.
Lorenzo, thank you. I appreciate it.
You know, Del, you had mentioned earlier Ron Paul, who ran for the Republican nomination. He was the only candidate in either party who was really for a policy which focused on defense and was opposed to our foreign wars. Where do people go today? I mean, obviously Obama, although the Democrats led the opposition to the war in Vietnam in the 60s, Obama is totally behind military expansion. Where do people go today who want a political base to stand on?
I don't know. That's a question that remains for the masses, huh? We're waiting for another hero. You know, I think...
I wonder, you know, some people say it's his son, Rand Paul, but, you know, Rand Paul would not come out forthrightly against the foreign wars.
And he's had his problems in Chicago, too.
And
I think part of the problem is we need a whole new ideology, too. I think we need a more of a nationalist ideal, the idea that, you know, the policy should be what benefits the American people and the United States comes first, and everything else, you know, whether it's economic policies or if it benefits private corporations or if it benefits, you know, foreign countries, like doling out our money to Egypt, Israel, Pakistan, you know, if that comes into conflict with what is best for the American people, we should discard it. And that's fundamentally, and along in that line, fundamentally, we also need a nationalist defense policy, which is going to say defense of the homeland, Japan, South Korea, all of these countries, you know what? You have to clean up your own house. You know, you have to take care of yourselves. We'll allow you to take care of yourselves. Heck, we'll give you the means to take care of yourselves. But we're not going to defend you. We're going to defend our home soil first. You know, and protecting our borders. I mean, people always, you know, I remember hearing Hillary Clinton drone on about what a bunch of Nazis the Republicans were because they wanted tighter border controls. But the fact is, no nation is sovereign if they can't control their borders. So what we need is a full-spectrum new ideology, a new national ideology. Like I say, it's something centered around the essence of protecting the rights and the livelihoods of Americans.
Gentlemen,
you know, we'd like to hear what you listeners think.
And yeah, we have a call on the line.
203. Do we have someone on the line now?
We have Ed from Ansonia.
Oh, hi, Ed. Great. Thanks for calling.
Ed, you're on.
Okay, yeah. I was just saying to the gentleman who received my call, I have a perfect example of how naive our politicians in our Washington are in relationship to our relationship with China. I read several years ago that the Chinese bought an old Russian aircraft carrier under the pretext they were going to turn it into a floating casino. Now, in all actuality, what they did was they're using it as a prototype for a series of carriers they're actually building right now. Meanwhile, while the Chinese are building aircraft carriers, the people in Washington are cutting our funding. They're decommissioning the Nimitz-class carriers. I hear they've delayed, if not completely canceled, our next generation of carriers. And the thing is, you don't need aircraft carriers to defend your coastline. They've got
other plans for those carriers.
And if we keep cutting our gutting our military, we're going to find out in a bad way what those plans are in the Pacific, I think.
Yeah, well, Sean, what do you think of Ed's comment?
You make a phenomenal point. I mean, one of my favorite examples is, like you said, the Chinese with the aircraft carrier, or the Russians developed this new Bure-class submarine, which everything the Russians develop, they give to the Chinese and vice versa. China came out with a new stealth fifth-generation fighter bomber. I mean, this thing's beautiful. On our latest fifth-generation fighter, it can't fly near lightning because it'll explode. But that was actually a story I read. It was on the Associated Press. It's a big problem. But the Chinese developed a successful fifth-generation fighter. Mysteriously, the Russians get the exact same design and develop the exact same thing. The Russians also developed the Bure-class submarine, which is a stealth submarine. It's like out of The Hunt for Red October. It uses an underwater sort of jet propulsion, and it runs silent. It's stealth. And the Chinese, I can guarantee, are getting this exact same technology. So while we're investing in drones, the Chinese and the Russians are investing in better fifth-generation technology. And this allows them to launch a first strike on the continental U.S. because now they can actually close the distance. They can get close. And because our fleets are so spread out, because we aren't investing in things like sonar nets, because we're not investing in early warning systems, because our fleet is in the Persian Gulf or way out in the, you know, in the South Pacific and not near the U.S., they know that this new submarine technology can really hit us at home. And it's the fact that our leadership's ignoring this, it's always the question of, are they corrupt or are they stupid or are they both? And I'm inclined to think there's a bit of both going on. Drones are more profitable for the companies that manufacture them. Boeing was given a no-bid contract of, it was billions, to develop an aircraft carrier-based drone. They hadn't even made it yet. It was an idea, and they were given billions for it. Totally impractical, totally worthless, but the U.S. government doled out billions for it. So, I mean, we do see a bit of stupidity combined with corruption, I think.
Was there any green technology tied into those drones?
That I actually don't know.
Just throwing it out there.
They might have been fuel efficient. You never know. I mean,
Ed, are you still with us?
No, Ed's off the line. He had some problems with feedback. Anybody that does call, just move the phone away from your radio, even though
and
you turn it down.
Our call-in number is 203-336-9756. That's 203-336-9756. And the name of the show is In Context. We're on every Monday from noon to 1 p.m., except the first Monday of the month, on WPKN 89.5 FM, Bridgeport, Connecticut, streaming live at WPKN.org. I'm your host, Ken. I'm here with our military affairs commentator, Marchand McDermott Rowe, and manning the board is our guest commentator, Dell.
Well, and ironically, actually, speaking of green technology, not that I know a whole lot about, oceanography, or the study of species that live in the water. But I would think that the new Bure class stealth submarine would probably be more gentle on the oceanic environment than the traditional propeller based submarines, just because these things move much more silently, they're much more gentle, you don't have the rotor blades. So while they might pulverize us into a pulp, one could say at least they'll do it with kindness to nature.
You know, Dell is, I know you know quite a bit about electronics. One of the interesting new weapons that we believe the Chinese have is this EMP bomb, where they could blow something up in our high atmosphere, which would fry all the electronic components of our equipment, military and civilian. So that's something we need to be worried about.
Without a doubt. I mean, I could imagine that would be incredibly dangerous, especially since now it appears that the Chinese might be able to localize it, so they can launch it in a torpedo form and detonate it underneath a ship and fry these ships' entire electronics.
You know, we talk about the, we're provoking the Chinese, we're provoking the Russians. The Chinese, part of their military philosophy going back over 2,000 years to Sun Tzu, is to encourage the enemy to overexpand, encourage his enemy to spread out, and then strike him where he's weakest. And one of the scariest thoughts about this global situation is that where the United States is weakest is right here in the United States, because we've got most of our army abroad.
Well, that's just it, and our emergency services. And this is something, whenever there's a major disaster, the Chinese and the Russians watch our response. And when Sandy hit, the fact that it took weeks to take care of all the refugees, weeks to get food and water in, the fact that we almost
still
had
still out of power over there. What are you talking about?
Huh?
They're still out of power over there.
Oh, well, there you go. Exactly. Exactly.
Imagine what they're going through now. Imagine what they're going through today. Right, it's been cold the last month or so, and what real emergency is there for getting people warm, getting them electricity, cleaning up their stuff? What, I mean, they got tents, yeah.
Exactly.
It's a refugee camp over there.
And imagine when the nor'easter hits on, I think it's supposed to hit on, like, Wednesday.
What did we just have?
Yeah,
I guess it was two snowstorms, I guess, that collided right over, I think, Bridgeport, New Haven. And but I guess the nor'easter is coming Wednesday.
Well, Jersey got nailed again.
Rain.
Yeah.
But it's what's, I mean, if you imagine, though, if you're the Chinese or the Russians, and you're the Chinese or the Russians, and you, let's say you see this, you know, you see that the Americans cannot, you know, cope with a natural disaster, a large one, or even a mild one. I mean, there's 700,000 people without power because of the snowstorm. Now, you're the Chinese and the Russians. You're looking at this. You go, no, geez, what would happen if we were to fire, let's say, one Bulava missile fired from a Bure-class submarine carries 10 warheads in it.
They're not going to do it directly. They're going to be hidden or do it through one of their surrogates, like you were saying.
Exactly. But let's say they gave one of these submarines to the North Koreans and had the North Koreans do it, even. You know, they know that if they dropped one of these warheads, because it has 10 warheads, you drop one, even if they're non-nuclear. I mean, we get up in arms over nuclear, but let's say if it was just a conventional incendiary ordnance and set fire to lower Manhattan, and you hit lower Manhattan, you hit Chicago, you hit L.A., you hit a bunch of major American cities, we wouldn't be able to cope with it. There would be anarchy.
I just want to remind listeners, we only have about...
We've got about six, seven minutes.
7 minutes. So we'd love to hear you, give you a chance to be on the air. Before
it's 203-336-9756. Joe called back in a minute ago, and he was talking about, you know, transparency in the government and whatnot. And where can he go to find out what the expenditures are by the U.S. government on certain things? I had a laugh. I'm sorry. I mean, you know.
You know, I just Google, and when we do shows on the budget, I just Google U.S. budget, federal budget, and for a given year, like 2000, and for fiscal year, I'll put in 2012 or 2013, and you'll get the complete U.S. government budget. The problem is, it's like 50 pages, and defense, for example, is broken down into so many different categories. It takes a long time to put it together, and I did for a show several months ago, and when I looked at the $3 trillion, we spend about $3 trillion. We take in a little bit more than half of that, and the big items in our budget are defense, are war and health care, and it's about $800 billion roughly for each. The war, but you have to look at war, you have to look at not just the Defense Department, but many other departments that have war-related budgets. And when it comes to health care, you're looking mainly at Medicaid and Medicare. But that's where the money goes. So if you look at our budget, two things scream out of it at you. You need to have a new defense policy and drastically cut back. And the other thing is, we need a complete overhaul of our health care system, because financially we're just spending too much money. It's about 17% of our GDP. It's insane.
So we won't see a line item for those Syrian jets?
No, you try to figure out where that is. I just ballpark it at around $800 billion when you throw in the war costs and the fixed. I think the actual fixed budget for the defense department is like $600 or $700 billion, something like that.
You won't see a line item for the drone program.
But you could probably find out. You could find out probably the best way to do that would just be budget for drones, because the CIA has its own air force of drone planes now. So there've been articles on that.
Part of the problem too is that a lot of these budgets are secret. Like the CIA's budget is secret. The NSA's budget is secret.
Which, yeah, it has to be. I was just being facetious and trying to.
You think about how ludicrous that is, though. That, well, we're a democracy, but we can't tell you how much of your money we're going to spend. I mean, it's not like...
Yeah, or seek your permission.
Get this now. There are hearings now. The drones are very big now because John Brennan has been nominated by Obama to become head of the CIA.
Oh, he's the man who says torture is a good idea.
Yeah, he turned down... He didn't seek the appointment 4 years ago when Obama came in because he was associated with torture, didn't want to be asked about it. Apparently, he's more able to confront that. But he's also a huge exponent of drone warfare. So now he's Obama's current top counterterrorism official. Now, he's being questioned by Senator Feinstein and members of the Intelligence Committee, and of course, they have no documents. And Feinstein, to me, has been pretty weak on it, says, well, you know, we keep asking the president to tell us these documents about the drone program, and you know what, they were told they're secret, and she stamps her foot, but she's not doing anything about it.
But this is kind of like, again, my favorite example, you know, people always think, in Stalin's Russia, they had a Politburo. Didn't mean Stalin had to tell him anything, but they still had elected Politburo.
This is what Feinstein's thinking. She says, we need another secret court so that the president will have to go to the secret court and present his kill list. And then in the secret court, they'll decide who can be offed by the United States president.
We got four minutes. 203-336-9756 if you want to get on this. I mean, pick a subject and go.
Yeah, jump on in. Come on. This is your one opportunity to join in on the forum, you know?
This is with Obama, a Democratic president, supposedly be a liberal, presiding over this great assault on our civil rights with secret courts and kill lists and all this nonsense.
One thing I want to throw out there, too, but before I forget and before we run out of time, is that that LAPD cop who's gone nuts and he's run off into the mountains. He killed another cop and killed a couple innocent bystanders. Anyway, they're discussing using drones to eliminate him. Now, he's an American citizen on American soil, and they're discussing using drones to eliminate him. If they used it, it would be the first domestic use of a drone strike within the continental U.S.
I did not hear that. I was off the grid for a day. I had to get some sleep. They wanted a drone,
right,
the guy.
You know, and how about the American citizen they killed in Yemen, right, Mark?
Well, but this would be different, though. That guy
way different.
Was not... That guy, and I only say it was different because I'm not justifying it at all, but the way they justified it is he said, well, he was an Al-Qaeda combatant. If they used it against this former cop in the U.S., who the guy's nuts, but if they used it against him, this would be not only using it against an American citizen, but it would be using it against a common criminal. This would set the presidents down to blow up people within the U.S.
Well, they take it inch by inch.
Inch by inch. That's why you got to stand up for your rights.
Yeah, before
and
they
we're holding it down every day at PKN, by the way. Listener-supported radio on 89.5 and WPKN.org. Got a couple minutes left on this program, 203-336-9756, and then you turn it over to music.
Thank you for joining us. And, Del, thank you so much for walking 3 miles to come to the stadium station to keep this listener-sponsored community radio station, WPKN, on the air. You know, our staff here is volunteer. And so, so we say, well, we'll double your pay, Del. It wouldn't mean anything. So thanks to you and people like Bruce Swan and Eric Cox, who was on early this morning, for making the struggle to get into the snowbound Bridgeport to keep the station going. And you can, of course, also make a contribution to WPKN.org while I'm on the subject, because we are listener-sponsored. And the reason why we can talk about...
Got a couple minutes left and a call on the line. This should be Jeff from Easton. Jeff, you with us?
Hello, Jeff. You're on the air.
Move away from your radio with that phone if you could. Okay, dude.
But
you're on.
Still is making feedback.
All right.
So how much worse does it get? You got a president who's got this private kill list. He can order you killed right now. You're dead.
Well, you have to do something bad. You have to do something bad to get on somebody's bad side.
How far does it go, Jeff? Yeah.
You were saying inch by inch. It's not inch by inch. It's done. What constitution rules this, you know, Congress and the president? We can tax you more. We can implement more rules and more monopolies. We can kill you. We don't have to put any bankers on trial.
How do we get it back, Jeff? How are we going to get our rights back?
How do we get it back? The people would need to stand up, and it could happen if everyone would.
Why would they do that? Why would they do that if they're getting free stuff? Why would they do that?
Well, as I always say, you know what?
They're not going to do that.
What part of it matters when the planet's collapsing? So what? Now we're going to get another storm and another one? When do people say, well, they still see people thinking that the climate hasn't changed? Yeah, you got to get people to stop living in a fantasy world. Good luck.
Yeah,
thanks for your call. Appreciate it. We're out of time.
That's the absolute, I agree completely.
That's a big subject. Sorry, you guys still there? I think I cut off the wrong guy.
Oh, no, we're still here.
Okay, let's sign out on this. We got to run some business and get on to the next program.
Great, and we'll be back on In Context. We'll be back on next Monday from noon to 1, and we'll be taking your calls. And thanks very much, Del, for joining us, and Marshawn. Listeners, we'll see you next week.
Yep. Thank you very much.
Thanks for being here with us, everybody.
Bye-bye.